Hello and welcome to True Crime Medieval, 1,000 Years of People Behaving Badly. I'm Anne Brannon, and I'm your host in Albuquerque.
And I'm Michelle Butler in Tuscaloosa.
And today, we're really excited about this because this was, a lot of fun for us. I don't know, it may be, Michelle, that whenever something is a lot of fun for us, it's really not much fun for anybody else.
It's possible.
It's possible, but we don't know, do we? And we're going to go on with this because we're going to talk about the Jacquerie, the French peasants' revolt in 1358, when the French peasants terrorized the nobility, mostly in the Oise Valley. That's where it started. Started in France. Yeah, 1358. Yeah, and it's all famous and everything. And we talked about the English Peasants' Revolt, which happens, 30 years later? Is it about 30? I think it is, Michelle.
The English Revolt is in 1381. And this is 1358.
The Jacquerie started in May of 1358 when some peasants in Saint-Loup massacred some noblemen and their families and continued for a few months until the nobility managed to massacre them in retaliation, brought some measure of order back, though many peasants left the area. And the name Jacquerie comes down in history. We call peasant revolts Jacquerie. So if you go, you can find things like the Jacquerie of Ukraine, the Jacquerie of Russia, the Jacquerie. If there's any kind of little peasant revolt, big or small, it's a Jacquerie. But the name itself comes from Jacques, which was what the commoners used as armor. It's a name, but also Jacques, like our word jacket, that's where it comes from. I knew you'd love that. The commoners used it as armor. It's a padded, quilted jacket, which bizarrely, I was surprised to find this out. It really was pretty good at keeping arrows from coming through, even heavy ones. It's not as good as metal armor, but you know, it's better than you would think. Any rate, so that's what the peasants wore, the Jacques. So they were called Jacques, like it's the name for peasants. And this is... any rate, they're wearing it. Jacquerie. So, all right. So what the hell? What happened? Where are we? Why did this happen? The Jacquerie get presented from about the time the revolt is suppressed to really a few years ago as a it's something that happened out of nowhere. Just like it was out of the blue, no discernible reason. Peasants they went nuts. They became barbaric savages. And they were indeed sort of barbaric during the revolt, but they weren't acting without reason, as usual. There's a background to this, which was kind of like getting ignored by everybody, especially the French nobility, completely ignored what the background was. So I will now tell you all the background of the Jacquerie, and there's a lot of it, let me tell you. First of all, the revolt comes about 40 years after the Great Famine of 1315 to 1317, which decimated the population of Europe, and 5 years after the end of the Black Death, which further decimated the populace of Europe. And one of the effects of having a fewer number of people at that time was that there were not enough commoners to do the work needed to keep the feudal system going. We notice that we don't have one now, do we? So it meant that both that work was harder and conversely that the commoners had more freedom because they were more in demand. But this sort of wasn't true in France. They were just kind of like being overworked. And it was also the middle of the Hundred Years' War between England and France, which had started in 1337, 20 years previously, and it was going to continue on and off until 1453. Joan of Arc doesn't show up until the 50s. She's not coming for a while. So Joan of Arc has nothing to do with the Jacquerie, just saying. And though the war was between England and France, all of the land battles took place on French soil, so all the depredations happened there. And more, 2 years before the uprising, the King of France had been captured in one of these Hundred Years' Wars by Edward the Black Prince, who was the son of Edward III, who was being the King of England at that time. He was captured at the Battle of Poitiers. So the country had been being governed for a couple of years by the Dauphin, who was acting as regent. He's going to be Charles V later, but he's just a prince right now. And with advice and some supposed help from the Etat General, which was, it doesn't really act like the English Parliament. It's more advisory. It doesn't really get to do a whole lot of stuff, but it tells you things and has opinions. And Charles had raised the taxes in order to strengthen the military. Because, of course, but then because he had a war, didn't he? And his dad was, you know, had been captured by England. And the nobility, of course, didn't like this because they don't want to pay more taxes. And they got divided. Some were favoring the King of Navarre as a claimant to the throne. And besides their disunity, the nobles had also not been really behaving really well as soldiers. At the beginning of the century, the French nobles had been massacred by the Flemish at the Battle of the Golden Spurs, which, though it had taken place 50 years before, was an infamous battle and very much in people's minds. And since the Hundred Years' War started, England was like winning. I mean, England was winning all the stuff. The king had been captured at the Battle of Poitiers. And there, the understanding was that the nobles had let the king be captured because they panicked, just as in the Battle of the Golden Spurs, the nobles had run. I mean, many of them were killed, but they had left and let the infantry, which was commoners, be slaughtered. Oh, by the way, spoiler alert, the English win the battles for most of the battles for quite a while in the Hundred Years' War, but they don't actually win them at the end, do they? Which is why when you go to Aquitaine, you are in France and not England. Ha ha, they lost. Okay. And you remember also that the taxes had been raised, and that meant that the nobles wanted the peasants to be even more productive because they needed more money so they could give more money to the king for the military, which they weren't being very good in. And even though the population had been diminished, so there should have been more availability of land and therefore movement of the lower classes, one of the things going on was that the land in France was connected to status. And the nobles kept their land, you know, even through all these times, and the peasants were stuck. And the nobles wanted more out of them. And then the money went to the military funds, and the military kept getting defeated. And it was all really disheartening. But there's more, because the battles in the aforementioned Hundred Years' War happened in France, and the French kept mostly losing. Mercenaries and various ruffians that the English had hired to fight they stayed there. Or when the English didn't need them anymore, they were fired, and so they were still around. And so what they did, all of the mercenaries that had been fighting for the English, they were roaming around northern France and robbing people and plundering and raping and basically being completely uncontrolled. And more, since feudalism was supposedly only fair to the peasants because they could count on the nobles whose land they were working, and who for whom they were making all this money, in terms of grain, the nobles protected them, didn't they? But the nobles kind of weren't, were they? Because they were just not living up to their, you know, side of the military bargain. They just mostly made things worse. Okay, that's my background. Do you have anything to add to the background? I think I got it all. Did you think I got it all?
The thing that I didn't know about until I was reading this is how bad the Battle of Poitiers was.
Oh, it was so bad.
It was so bad. I mean, on the English side of things, we always hear about Agincourt.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do.
Because it's become such a big piece of how England understands itself.
Mm-hmm. Well, they won the Battle of Poitiers too, but it's not, I don't know.
They did, but it didn't become this piece of their self-mythologizing.
Mm.
And so I did not know how bad, or if I had known, I'd forgotten, you know,
no,
that the French king was captured and so many of the nobles were killed, and that it had this huge, huge impact on how the French understood themselves and how the non-nobles had a legitimate grievance here about being right. not only not protected when you have all of these armies, you know, they're stealing from them. They're replenishing their supplies by stealing from the non-nobles. So that's I think that's a legitimate thing to be upset about.
Yeah. Yeah, and both the French have been losing stuff, but these battles in which the nobles like basically turn tail and run, you know, they're getting slaughtered, but they're also abandoning. They abandon the king,
and the French king had sent home there. Some of the non-nobles had gotten a group together. Hey, we're here to help, and he's like, "Go home. It's not your job to fight. And anyway, we'll do so much better of a job than you." So
on account of being noble, yeah,
yeah,
yeah, because we're like. No hot stuff. All right, that's our background. We go on to our Jacquerie. In May of 1358, there were some peasants who met together at Saint-Loup to discuss their political and economic situation. And their target consisted specifically of 9 noblemen who had been sent to garrison a castle, which was meant to be used to attack Paris. Okay, what's going on there? Another little revolt. Etienne Marcel, who was a revolutionary leader from the town, held Paris after having had a coup against the crown. So that's what was going on. So Paris was, you know, the Paris was being held by revolutionaries. And so the Jacquerie killed the 9 noblemen in sympathy with Paris, where they said they killed nobles, you know, so. And then the revolt spread. They continued to support Paris, but their objective pretty much was to destroy the nobility, which held money and military and wasn't doing any good with either one of them. And the idea that there was actually reasoning behind the Jacquerie and there was organization, this is a fairly new idea. So we are completely impressed with Justine Fernhaber Baker. Oh, she's a professor at St. Andrews. Or do you remember? I think it's St. Andrews.
I know when the book was published and who published it.
Well, I know the 2021. Who published it?
Oxford.
Yeah. She published in 2021, she published the first book on the Jacquerie since the first one, which had been written in 1859.
You are correct. She's at the University of Andrews.
Yeah, Andrews, yeah. It's wonderful because it's a matter of going back and looking at the archives and the records and figuring out what happened. She says at one point that it's actually difficult to figure out what happened because the sources are so sketchy. And and one of the things also that I hadn't occurred to me was that with the English peasants' revolt, we have writing from the peasants' revolt, the side of the peasants' revolt itself. We have stuff. Nothing from the Jacquerie. It's all from chronicles that were almost all of them were written sometime after. One is closer, but there's been like some buffer time. And the chronicles are the one that tell us how atrociously there was atrocities and there was barbarism and there was no reason for any of this, blah, blah, blah. It's the medieval chronicles that tell us that.
They're sympathizing with their patrons.
They sure as hell are. Yeah. But one of the things also that we have are the remissions because later when there's an amnesty, their crimes are put in. We have it all written down where people are being pardoned and whatnot. And so we kind of know what it was, which pretty much was not anything that the medieval chroniclers said. At any rate, it's extremely recently that scholars have been talking about it as a political revolt rather than some spontaneous barbaric fury, which is really how the French nobles looked at it, because there was no reason for the peasants to be unhappy, obviously, since they were peasants and the nobles weren't. There you go. So it was prominently chronicled. There was a lot of writing about it in the histories. And it's true. I mean, you know, the medieval chronicles focus on the atrocities and the barbarism, but the peasants in the Jacquerie did massacre some nobles when they found them. The chronicles present the Jacques as irrational and the nobles as terrified. There's no political context for the uprising in the chronicles. But they were not a mob. They had military organization. They had captains. They had lieutenants. They were violent. This is absolutely true. But the accusations of atrocities are actually not backed up by the archival evidence. It looks like there was a fear of noble women being raped, for instance, rather than noble women actually being raped. And the story of the Jacques roasting a nobleman on a spit in front of his children and his wife does seem to have some evidence, but that's it. They killed noblemen, they killed women, and it looks like it amounted to about 20 people. But they were scary to the nobles. What they were doing, what they really did, was they were very violent against property. That's what they were. They attacked houses and fortresses and castles and towers, and they destroyed them and whatever was in them. They didn't loot them. They did not loot them. They destroyed the stuff that was in them. Yeah, so they were not going around raping. There was all these stories of gang rape, and it was not happening. And all these stories of mass massacres of noblemen. They did indeed kill some people, but they did not do what the stories have come down to us. This is fascinating to me.
I really appreciated her discussion of the role of Charles of Navarre.
Oh, Charles of Navarre. Yes, because he was a claimant to the throne and a mortal enemy of the Dauphin and the Dauphin's father. And yet, I'm about to say what he did. Yes.
It was pretty fascinating.
Yes, you'll probably be adding some stuff. But so this revolt happened and it got suppressed, didn't it? It's not still going on. It got stopped. And it was suppressed when the Dauphin allied with Charles of Navarre, as we were just saying, who was the other claimant to the throne. And they led a company of nobles at Melun in June. They invited the leader, the Jacquerie, his name was William Kael. They invited him to truce talks. And then they tortured him to death and cut his head off because they said that he wasn't their equal. And so the laws of chivalry didn't apply to him, because generally you are not supposed to invite people to a truce talk and then kill them. That's really bad manners and goes against chivalric code. You remember that one of the William de Brazes did that to Cecil of Dinamal. Come to a peace talk. Then he shut the doors and killed everybody. So they killed him because he foolishly believed that they were going to treat him as a military equal. No. And at that point, the peasant army fell apart and the knights slaughtered them. And at the same time, at the town of Meaux, Etienne Marcel led a troop of armed commoners from out of Paris, bourgeois from Paris, to support the uprising. And they took the town of Meaux, took them in. They took the rebels in. They were very hospitable. But Gaston Phoebus, did you read about him? Because he's also fascinating.
I don't think so. I was trying to hunt down some stuff about the spice merchant.
Oh, you were on the spice merchant. Yes, I do not know. So. No, Gaston Phoebus, he's one of the few people we know of who actually gave themselves their own nickname and it stuck. So he gives himself the nickname Phoebus, Apollo, you know, the sun. This is after he has been in one of the crusades against Prussia because, you know, Prussians weren't being Christian enough at any rate. So he gave himself that name. And so Phoebus came back with a force of lancers, came toward the town. While he was coming, the nobles who were being besieged in the fortress, they took heart because, you know, the cavalry was pretty literally the cavalry was coming. And so they burned up a bunch of townsmen in a town nearby, and they hanged the mayor along with some other important townsmen. And then they set fire to the town, and the town burned for quite some time, 2 weeks or something. And then they went out in the countryside and they killed all the peasants they could find. And for two more months, towns that had sheltered the Jacques fought back against the noble forces, and the peasants got all slaughtered. And the gist of all this is that the nobles who put down the revolution were much, much, much more brutal than the peasants were.
Yeah.
Here's us not being surprised.
Yeah.
And they're the ones, you know, it's from their point of view that the story's told. The reason they had to suppress this at all was that the peasants had been being so badly behaved. So the Dauphin declared amnesty at the end of 2 months, and he put heavy fines on all the places where the Jacquerie had been supported. More money for, more money for the crown. But the letter of amnesty, his letter of amnesty condemned the nobles' violence as much as the peasants. So I actually have some good feelings about that. So at that point in time, they knew, they knew.
Mm-hmm.
That disappears. And though the remissions list the crimes, there's the infamous atrocities are just simply not in there. Now, there's a wonderful annotated map of incidents in the Jacquerie, which is online. It's one of the Google maps. And I could not find the name of the user. It's put together by a Google user. And so you can click on things. You can see where all the damage was done and who did what. And we'll put the link in the show notes. Did you run across that?
You'll have to send that to me.
I'll send it to you.
So I can put that in the show notes because, I didn't find that.
Oh, yeah. It's wonderful. Yeah. There's no atrocities. The Jacquerie had no political impact on France. It changed nothing structural. And it did nothing to help the peasants or make their lives easier. What it did was it terrorized the nobility and it caused them to have, they had, very, very horrible fantasies about what was happening, what the peasants were doing to them. And that's what it was, its impact. Its impact was a legend of the atrocities committed by the barbarous peasants for no reason. If the nobles learned anything at all from this, was it that, we should treat the peasants better, or maybe we shouldn't take so much money from them, or I don't know, maybe we should do some military exercises and become better soldiers. The only thing they learned was that the peasants were dangerous. And so that did lead to some things. It was castle reinforcements and, making structures, safer against the peasants. But the term Jacquerie for the revolt didn't come into general usage until the French Revolution. And since then, it's remained as a label for bloody and brutal peasant rebellions. The noble suppression was much more bloody and brutal than the Jacquerie. What were you going to tell me about Charles of Navarre?
I enjoyed her discussion of him because he really is just a force of chaos in this.
Was it his idea to slaughter all the peasants?
Well, he's king of this independent country that is between France and Spain. Because, Navarre is part of northern Spain and it was its own standalone country at this point. And he encourages the peasant uprising until it's in his best interest to switch sides because, it's causing problems for the Dauphin. And so he's encouraging this and he's got his own mercenaries that he's brought back and he's put up in some of his empty castles. And they're out also causing problems.
Of course they are.
Stoking bad feelings. And he's just working from the assumption that the more problems he can cause in France, the better for him, because that's lighting fires that the Dauphin has to try to put out. And until it becomes in his best interest to turn on this and put it down, what a rat bastard. One of the novels that I found calls him Charles the Wicked. And
I like that.
I'm not going to argue with that as a way of understanding him.
He never did become king of France, by the way, in case anybody was wondering. So my understanding, Michelle, is that you were able to find many things that you were excited about.
Oh my gosh.
Popular treatment of the Jacquerie episode of French medieval history.
I did. I did not find as much as I would have liked to have found about the historical personage who was a spice merchant from Montpellier.
Who is the spice merchant? What are you talking about?
His name was Pierre, G-I-L-L-E-S. Guy. He was a spice merchant and he becomes a rebel commander who works with the other one that you just mentioned.
William Kale.
And there's another one who was a Hospitaller.
Oh, really? So one of the knight monk orders was Somebody from the monk orders was in on this.
Marcel. His name is Marcel.
Cool.
So I wanted to find out more about that, but I didn't. So there we go.
Yes, and now I want to know, did he ever adulterate the saffron? We refer you to our previous podcast on saffron, don't adulterate it in Nuremberg in the Middle Ages, because it's a deathly thing to do.
Not surprisingly, the Jacquerie was quite a spur to the imagination throughout the 19th century and into the 20th century, actually.
Oh, really?
And in French, in English, in Italian, and in Spanish.
Oh, lovely.
I have stuff in all four of those languages. There's a novel from 1842, which I think is in three pieces. You can find it like volume one, volume two, volume three. But I was looking at it on, because it's so far out of print, you know, it's legal for it to be scanned and be online. So that's where I was looking at it. The premise of this one is called The Jacquerie or The Lady in the Page and Historical Romance by G.P.R. James. And it's from 1842. So that's pretty early.
I saw that. And the fact that it was an historical romance caused me to believe that I did not want to read it.
Well, it was interesting to me to look at the different ones and see where the sympathy of the book is.
Is it ever with the Jacquerie?
Yes.
Oh.
Sometimes. But not this one. This one has a French soldier who had been fighting as a mercenary in Germany, arrives back home in the middle of the Jacquerie, and his sympathy is immediately with the poor murdered nobles against the senseless brutality of the peasant.
Were there atrocities? They wouldn't be described, but they might be mentioned.
Oh, yes.
Done in ways that I cannot now speak of, that kind of thing.
There's definitely atrocities. And he, you know, is in the inn. And the priest says to him, haven't you heard? And he says, no. And the priest says, well, here's what's going on. And he says, holy cow, tell me who I need to kill. So that's all the further I read in that.
Yeah, I think I can miss this. Thank you for looking at it so that I don't have to read it. What else did you find?
Also, there's one from 1888. This is also in English, called Before the Dawn, A Story of Paris and the Jacquerie. And this is it wasn't published under this name. It was published under a pseudonym, but it's by George Perkins. This one actually is sympathetic to the peasants. It has wonderful purple prose. Oh my gosh, I have to share this with you. Here we go. You ready? Here we go.
I'm ready. Lay it on me.
This book starts with, at the distance of several leagues from Paris, on the edge of the forest of Hermon, stood a cottage built of logs, turf, and clay. A miserable dwelling, the home of a peasant, that is to say, of a despised creature, a wretch derisively called Jacques Bonhomme. Let us enter. We see a rude table formed of slabs, two stools on which are seated a man and a woman, a heap of straw in one corner serving for a bed, and a hearth upon which smolders a feeble fire, whose smoke escapes as best it may through an open hole in the roof. On the clay floor are crouched three or four small children with wan, pinched faces, for hunger is here within easy reach of the game that crowds the forest. What prevents the miserable wretch from taking his bow and shooting one of the deer that come fearlessly to his very door, from snaring the hares that frisk about in the neighboring thickets? What compels him to endure the sight of his famishing children, who stretch out their hands and ask for food? This prevents him, death or his right hand stricken off, if he is detected in the act of killing the game that belongs to the nobles. So this book is very sympathetic to the peasants. Now, it's this very stereotypical 19th century understanding of what it means to be a medieval peasant. You can see this kind of Robin Hood-y sort of understanding of the world. But this is actually William Callot, we find out in the next paragraph.
Oh.
Who becomes a leader of it. And it's being, you know, you have this justification, right? His children are starving. So what are you going to do? Of course you're going to.
The idea that there was a justification is floating around that early.
Mm-hmm. 1888. That wasn't as purpley when I was reading it out loud, but it's pretty purpley.
What is the name of this author?
This is called Before the Dawn, A Story of Paris and the Jacquerie. And the book was published, let me go back a page here. The book was published under the name Georges Dulac, but that was a pseudonym for George Perkins. And that was published in New York and London by Putnam. But I like the kind of, this is probably my favorite one of the ones I found, because I like how it really wants to present this sympathetic, but is kind of like over the top about it, because how do you not know how many children are crouching on the ground? Three or four? This is not an area in which there should be.
Yeah, the room is too small to lose them.
What do you mean three or four small children? Like, this is a place you can be precise.
I like the smoke going out the roof as best it may, as if it has agency. I'm going this way, guys.
Everything about this house is dreadful. It's all dreadful.
I wanted to know what else he wrote, but I'm not seeing it. All I'm seeing is Before the Dawn.
The next one that I found was written in French originally and then was translated in 1906. It's called The Iron Trevet, or Jocelyn the Champion, A Tale of the Jacquerie. Now, what is fascinating, this is the one that calls him Charles the Wicked. This one is really interesting because it shows the emergence of the uprising, but one of the just, and its sympathies are with the peasants, and one of the justifications given for it is Drot de Seigneur.
Oh, no, no, the yes. thing that doesn't exist.
Yes.
Oh, my God. So this thing that doesn't exist has been just like grafted on to this legendary story.
Yes, this is fascinating because it has William Callett, the same guy who's the rebel leader, who is also the protagonist of the previous one. This one has this whole made up story with William Callett's daughter having been Drot de Seigneur.
Now you have to, just in case somebody's listening is not remembering or not catching what that is, you have to explain. I'll drop this in you.
Here, I'll just read you a little couple sentences because it's clear in here. She was affianced to a miller lad, a vassal like herself. By reason of the goodness of his disposition, he was called Mazarek the Lambkin. So her fiancé is so gentle, he's called Lambkin.
Oh.
Aw. The day of their marriage was set, but in these days, the wife's first night belongs to her seigneur. The nobles call it the night of first fruits. So we talked about this in April Fool's Day episode, the idea that you have to sleep with the Lord. You have to give your virginity to the Lord. But I was just flipping through this book trying, I'm like, wait a second, hold up, there it is, on page 121, yes!
So this is a French book, and it's sympathetic to the Jacques.
Yeah. There's a 1961 novel called A Walk with Love and Death that was made into a movie in 1968. The movie is really fascinating because it's trying to piggyback on the success of Zeffirelli's Romeo and Juliet.
Oh.
The novel is essentially a story of star-crossed lovers, so it doesn't need to be set during the Jacquerie. That's just this useful backdrop and providing an excuse for this nobleman's daughter to meet up with a poor scholar on the run from the violence in Paris. It's John Huston is the director. And what's really fascinating about this film, retrospectively, if you're a fan of the Addams Family, is that one of the reasons he did this movie is that it was a vehicle for his daughter, Angelica. It was her first big screen role.
That was her first.
Mm-hmm. But it's rough, man. It really is like Romeo and Juliet. They try to run away together, but everybody abandons them. There's no protection from the lords. It's very dangerous to be out and about. They take refuge in a monastery, and the monks abandon them. When they take off to go be safe somewhere else, and they leave them there.
Well, you know, there's been this whole theme of people getting abandoned by the nobles in battle. And so I kind of like seeing that this theme of abandonment is going on through the 1961 movie. That's good.
And then they get abandoned by the monks. They marry themselves in the church, in the monastery, you know, and are waiting for that. You can hear the mob coming.
Yes. The mob that's full of atrocities making.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm. And got to kill them for no good reason.
Because, you know, they're alive.
So I would not say that one has sympathy with the, you know, with the peasants, but really they're just there to provide a threat.
It doesn't really examine the peasants either. It's not like, because the peasants are just simply a kind of plot tool getting moved around. Yeah.
There's two operas.
I knew about one. I did not know about the other. When were these done?
1894 and 1919. One is for sure in Italian, and I think the other one is in Spanish. There's a play in Spanish, and that's really early. I didn't dig into this very far because I can't find a translation of it, and my Spanish isn't that fabulous. But there's a book of, it's called The Plays of Clara Gazul, who was a Spanish comedian, and one of her plays is about the Jacquerie.
And wait. Because the Jacquerie is hilarious?
I have no idea. I'm telling you, I don't even know for certain it's about the French Jacquerie. So I'm giving you this one with a giant asterisk.
It might be about any various numbers.
But I'm throwing it in here because it's so early. It's from 1825.
Wow.
That book is from 1825. And, you know, anybody who wants to go figuring out what it is, be my guest, because it's entirely in Spanish. And I was not able to locate a translation of it, but it's fascinating. I remember I said to you that all I needed now was a French or a Finnish death metal song. I didn't find that, but I did find that there is a German progressive rock band from 1965 that has a concept album called Power and the Passion, and it does take part of it in France in 1358 with the Jacquerie being important. So I feel like I scored the entire spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think frankly that a German experimental rock concept album is equal to a Finnish heavy metal album. I think, what was his name? Christopher Lloyd. Who was it that did the heavy metal album that we were talking about?
No, it's not Christopher Lloyd. What is his name? Saruman. He played Saruman. Christopher Lee.
Oh, so Christopher Lee didn't have an album about this because, you know, that would also...
No, not as far as I can tell.
Okay, too bad. Yeah.
There probably is a bunch of artwork too, but I didn't go and dig into that. I was, you know, looking at the historical fiction because it was really fascinating how different books fully have their sympathy either with the nobility or with the peasants. But the presentation of the peasants is so very stereotypically dreadful.
You know, usually in terms of like art, usually when we're looking up these things that were these events that were popular in the 19th century, there will be a whole lot of 19th century art. Also, like The Black Dinner got a bunch of that. But the imagery about the Jacquerie actually is mostly medieval.
Huh. Fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, there's some stuff later. You know, there's some, like, you know, there's some nice woodcuts and whatnot. But yeah, there is some later. It isn't like the artist didn't touch it at all. But it isn't that popular kind of thing as, like, for instance, the Siege of Constantinople or the Sicilian Vespers, you know. Where you look up the images and they go on and on and on and on. Oh, or that time that King John had his nephew murdered. That show, there's a lot of 19th century imagery about that. And the boys in the tower. But not about the Jacquerie.
Yeah, it's such a perfect storm of all of these things coming together. And then, you know, you have this uprising, which then is just comes down to us as this time of such horrific atrocities. And, you know, as we go poking at it, we find, well, actually, they were relatively restrained. Although it gets kicked off with that, you know, murder of 9 noblemen to...
Yeah.
But then they're basically property damage. But there's pretty significant violence to put it down. And it was interesting to me that the sorts of crimes that the peasants are accused of having done during this uprising are the same kinds of crimes that they're accused of having done during the Great Famine. So we have all of these accusations of cannibalism and wanton violence and rape. Like, it's the same set of things that we saw people being accused of during the Great Famine that there weren't evidence of then either.
Right.
That's just the toolbox of how to say that the non-nobles are expressing their discontent.
Yeah. Yeah. The nobles are very scared of the peasants.
And I'm sure that since this is French, you have some reading it backwards through the lens of the French Revolution.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. You often see people talking about it as being kind of pointing toward the French Revolution. I don't think it really does. It's different. But one of the things also that I find interesting about the Jacquerie is that, well, let me put it this way. What did they want? What did they want to happen?
They wanted to, well, they say they want to be protected. They say they want to have the Lord stop stealing everything from them.
Did they say that? Because we don't have their writings.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's hard because we don't have...
Because we don't know. And we know how bad the circumstances were.
Right.
And we know that there were many, many pieces of the badness of the circumstances.
Yeah.
But this is not, they're not like shouting, give us bread.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they're even shouting death to all the nobles, although it looks like they're trying to kill all the nobles, but that's what the nobles think. What they are, they are getting rid of property, but what exactly?
Yeah.
You know, they're pissed off. The nobles have not been behaving. So, you know, we can extrapolate, well, maybe they want the nobles to behave, but we don't really know. Whereas with the English peasants' revolt, we have a list. Here's what we want. They don't get
right.
Any of it, but we have a list of what they want.
That's true. Either that never existed or it's not been preserved.
Yeah, but I find that really interesting because I'm like, what
yeah.
is it?
No, you're right.
What is it they want? And often it's true, as it for something like Piers Plowman is a lovely example. I mean, it's true that a lot of time in medieval rebellions, what is wanted is not an overthrow of the system, which actually the peasants' revolt said they wanted. We want an end to serfdom. You know, it isn't that the system needs to go, but that the people in the system need to do their parts. So, you know, the churchmen need to be good churchmen and the nobles need to be good noblemen and the peasants need to be good peasants and then everything will be okay. But it isn't usually a reimagining of how things should be. And I'm not seeing if there's a reimagining here. I don't know what it is.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it was one of those horrible questions where wait a minute. Yeah, we can extrapolate, but I don't think we know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, her book provides a really useful reminder that so much of our source material is not unbiased. That all kind of chronicles have a perspective, but these ones in particular are from the point of view of the nobles who are paying the bills, and so of course they're saying, "Boy, this was dreadful. This was just appalling."
And there was no reason for it. There was no reason for it. I mean, see, that's, if people are going around with a list of grievances and we want this and we want that, it's really hard to say there's no reason for it because here's my list. It's like, there is no list. So the noblemen are able, so there's no reason. They all just went nuts. We don't know why. Ah, the Jacquerie. So it becomes infamous. Yeah, it gets referred to in the French Revolution, but there's not a clear line running from one to the other. I mean, the French Revolution, they were pretty clear what they want. What do we want? We want no nobles and you're dead. So we're gonna restructure everything. That's our plan. Give me a guillotine.
Her discussion also about how there's uprisings both in the city and in the countryside, but not necessarily for the same reasons.
Yes.
Is a useful reminder.
Yes, because the townspeople sort of typically saw themselves as being better than the peasants because the commoners in the town are what will become the bourgeoisie. They do things like maybe goldsmiths and grocers and whatnot. They're not working the land. And so it's interesting to see so early on that split between urban and rural that, for instance, here in America is a big, big damn deal these days.
Yeah, they're both up in arms, but it's not necessarily the same reasons.
And they're not always working together. Sometimes they are and sometimes they're not. The city piece of it kind of gets lost. It becomes distilled down into, well, the, you know, the peasants. It's just the countryside. It's just the peasants. The city part of it gets lost as it comes down as an ideological understanding.
Yeah, although this is true. Although Etienne Marcel himself, other statues of him, you know, he comes down as a figure, but exactly where it is he fits in is not as clear. There's kind of a lionization of him, but it's not clear how it's all connecting to the history that we're talking about at the moment. If you're having a coup, then what you want is pretty clear. We want you to not be in power, and we will be in power instead. That's what. Yes. And they had a coup in Paris. It's not what was going on with the Jacquerie.
And there's a lot of remissions handed out, but not for the leaders of this. They get executed. The Spice Merchant, for example.
Although not the not the noble leaders. No. They don't get executed.
No.
Yeah, and William had already been murdered, assassinated.
It's just fascinating to me, really, that the reasons that get attributed to the peasants for the uprising were actually true during the Great Famine. You know, everybody's starving.
Uh-huh.
And there isn't an uprising then. Not really.
I'll tell you, though, that one of the things about uprisings when you're starving is that it's really hard to do because you are not in, you can't do it.
Yeah.
There wasn't an uprising during the Irish Famine. There wasn't an uprising during the Holodomor. That's not when you do these things. What you're doing is lying around in the street dying. It's just very, very hard to get an uprising together.
I found a really interesting article about the movie A Walk with Love and Death by Kevin Hardy, who's a medievalist, from the articles from 1999. And one of the points he makes is that this is medievalism, that this kind of story being told in this way is using the medieval as a place, but it's, even if it's trying, as it may or may not be, to be historically accurate, you can't actually do that, right? So you have, it is very much also a product of the 60s. So the young people are embracing premarital sex in a way that is very much a product of the ideology of the 1960s.
We know that people had premarital sex, but they talked about it differently. Well, that was our discussion of the Jacquerie and an historical revision of the idea of the Jacquerie. The next time that you hear from us, we're going to be talking about the pretenders who showed up after the boys in the tower disappeared. So they're pretenders to the throne of England, supposedly one of the boys in the tower, though they weren't. And spoiler alert. And so that will be fun. So we're going to go back to England.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm reasonably certain that pretending to be the heir to the throne is a crime. I think we're on totally safe ground there.
Yeah, there's even some death involved. You know, there's not wholesale slaughter, if I remember correctly, but there's is some death. Anyway, so that's what we'll do. And this has been True Crime Medieval, where the crimes are just like they are today, only with less technology. You can find us on any of the places where the podcasts hang out, Apple and Spotify, various places. And you can also find us at truecrimemedieval.com. True Crime Medieval is all one word. There's links to the podcast and show notes and transcripts. And I usually find lovely pictures of whatever's going on, so you can have those too. And you can leave comments for us, and you can reach us through there. And yeah. And if you know of any medieval crimes that you think that we should pay attention to that we haven't talked about yet, let us know. They might be on our list, or they might not. Got a long list. You can always use more material. Yeah, so that's us. Yeah, bye.
Bye.